Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should. Here's your host, Mark Davin.
All right, folks, welcome back to a special episode of Guitar Radio Show. Today is August 17th, and we're actually going to release this episode today, so you're going to have it in front of your naked, steaming ears right away. Today, August 17th, 2019. Earlier this week, this past Tuesday, the fantastic new biography on Stevie Ray Vaughan called Texas Flood, The Inside Story of Stevie Ray Vaughan by Alan Paul and Andy Elidort was released. And I've got a bunch of questions for these guys. And then later on today, they're going to be at, is it Book People? You're going to be at Book People,
yes,
right?
Yes, sir, 2 o'clock at Book People.
Yeah, you're going to be at Book People in Austin, and that's one of our hallowed bookstores in Austin, Texas. And then later on in the evening at Seaboys Heart and Soul, one of my favorite clubs, at 7:30 p.m. this evening. And it's a great room. I don't know if you guys have been there, but it's a great room. It sounds really good, but all the rooms in Austin sound good. So it's going
to
be fun.
Down in Austin, I got to see Jimmy Bond there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's a great. What a great room to see him.
That's my experience with Seaboys. So yeah. Very honored to be taking over that room tonight.
Super cool. So, folks, welcome to the show, Mr. Alan Paul and Andy Elidort. Andy's returning. He's been a guest before. How are you guys? I know you are sequestered in a vehicle on I-35 making your way south to Austin.
We're still standing. We're still standing. We're sitting at the moment, but yeah, it's been a whirlwind couple of days in Texas, but you know, it's really exciting. It's whirlwind because, you know, Stevie Ray fans out there are excited about our book and want to hear from us. So it's all good. We're honored to be spreading the gospel of Stevie, especially in Texas.
Very
cool.
We've been going since
Monday, Mark. So, you know, we had events up north, New York City Monday,
yeah.
New Jersey Tuesday, Long Island Wednesday, then Houston Thursday, and Dallas yesterday, Austin today. But every day, aside from the book events at the bookstores, it has been press, radio, XM radio, newspapers, TV spots. So it's just been wild, and but really, really great. Last time we got to see some of Stevie's family, his cousins and aunt in Dallas, and you know, Stevie Ray, I mean, this is the place to be. You know, he's so beloved. A lot of these people were his friends that grew up with him. There was a woman last night who said Stevie Ray snuck a kiss when they were 8 years old. You know, so, and I want to say that we went by Laurel Land, where Stevie's buried yesterday, and saw his marker, and it was very, very moving for us both to be there. You know, after spending 3 years writing the story of this guy and doing everything we could to bring him to life, you know,
yeah,
make him alive in the pages of this book. I can't even describe, you know, what it was like to be, you know, at his resting place. Because, like, you know, we wanted to honor Steve with the book, and we also thank you for taking the time to help us, you know, spread the word.
Yeah, I think what you have to understand, just to follow up on Andy said, is that in order to bring Stevie alive in the book and pages for all of you guys, to, we had to bring him alive to ourselves. So I mean, it sounds crazy because obviously we know the outcome before we start, but there's still something about being at his resting place and seeing his marker that was such a finality that it really kind of took both of our breaths away. And I feel like even saying that out loud, it sounds kind of goofy because it seems like it should be so obvious, but you know, emotions are what they are, and that was a very real thing.
Well, you know, it's interesting because as I read the book, because I finished it late last night, and I plowed through it from Tuesday morning when I got it, and then I plowed through it. I finished it late last night, and my main takeaways was, even though I didn't have the audiobook, I could hear the voices of all the people, including Stevie, as I read the book, you know. And I've interviewed some of these folks before in the past, particularly Tommy and Chris and folks like that. And I found that the book has this. I found that the book has this wonderful organic nature to it, in that it really is so conversational that you kind of get lost in the fact that, oh, I'm reading a book. It's like, no, I'm hearing all these voices. Was that something that you actually thought about beforehand, or is that just kind of a happy accident?
Part of the reason for that, Mark, is that there were, even though the majority of the book is constructed from, you know, over 100 separate interviews, or I should say, interviews with over 100 people,
yeah, which, multiple times, so it's way over 100.
Yeah, which resulted in, you know, 500 interviews. And then we wove the comments together, so there was a narrative flow to it. But there are chunks of the book that come from conversations where Chris Layton, the drummer from Double Trouble, and Tommy Shan, the bass player, Reese Wine, the keyboard player, and myself are all in the same room. So that's in the book, the actual back and forth between them that was happening in real time when those conversations took place. So, you know, we did what we could to create that feeling from interviews and comments and quotes that were collected. But some of them, that's the reality of what was said.
And I think even more important, to add to what Andy said, is not just those interviews with Chris and Tommy and Reese, but the interview with Jimmy and Stevie. Andy did one of, and we think maybe the only joint interview with Jimmy and Stevie for Family Style. Mm-hmm. And at the very start of the book, in the first chapter, where there's so much back and forth with Jimmy and Stevie talking about their childhood and their early musical influences, we reinforce some of that with Jimmy later, but most of that is really from the actual back and forth with Jimmy and Stevie. And I think it's so wonderful that Andy did that, so we had it available. And I think it did set the tempo for how that should feel. And mm-hmm. So it gave us something to kind of strive for as we put together the rest of the book and the other culture people. It kind of set the template for what it should feel like.
Mm-hmm. And if you get the audio book, there are audio clips included from my interviews with Stevie and from that interview with Jimmy. And that interview with Stevie and Jimmy that I did, none of that audio has ever, ever been heard by anyone other than me. It's never been shared in any way until now. So there's about a 3-minute clip that we included in the audiobook of the brothers going back and forth, and it's just the most wonderful thing, and very rare.
Yeah.
To hear, you know, just them picking on each other and laughing at each other's jokes. You know, it's the clearest picture that you could get of the true nature of their relationship, which is, of course, at the core of this book.
Right, because that's one of our essential things, and that's the other reason we started with that bulk of that interview with Jimmy and Stevie, is that it is at the core of the book, and you can't really understand Stevie unless you understand Jimmy and their relationship, both musical and otherwise.
Yeah, I you know, it's so funny because I keep hearing about you talking about the feel of it, and it is really an emotional account of that time and his times and the man and all the people around him, and there were points in there from early on and of course much later on where I had a hard time emotionally reading some of it, you know, like the stuff about Stevie's dad, and how when Jimmy had left home, how, you know, kind of Stevie was left to fend for himself and had to navigate his dad and his dad's moods and all. And that was very emotional. And you know, it made me see him in a different way. I didn't know about that stuff. That was really hard to read.
Well, you know, there's a variety of things. You know, when you set out to write a book, you know, everybody has their own viewpoints, and you know, you can't understand Stevie without understanding, you know, the trials and tribulations he went through as a person. But there's no way we were going to let this thing devolve into dirty laundry and mudslinging and stuff that's salacious. So what happens is it becomes this balancing act that you have to be very aware of, that you want the reader to get the right idea of where this guy came from in his history and his past, but in the right perspective without leaning too far into something that's just there, you know, because unfortunately there are people who, you know, they want to read dirt, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
So we did everything we could to tell the story, be honest, and you know, Jimmy Vaughn helped us in that way too, because you could talk about some of the things, you know, that went on, and when he moved out, you know, he said his father was just trying to do the best he could, you know, like, he was scared for Jimmy. You know, Jimmy was 14 years old, quit, drops out of school, ninth grade, moves into an apartment complex with guys that are 19, 20, 21 years old. And who wouldn't, what father wouldn't freak out that their 14-year-old son, you know, is now, who knows what the hell he's doing.
And even given that it was a very different era, and maybe it was a little more common not to finish high school and stuff, Even allowing for that, it's still a pretty extraordinary situation. And, you know, Andy and I are both parents. It's not that hard to imagine, mm-hmm. you know, being sort of alarmed about your child.
So Jimmy said that. He said, he goes, you know, my dad is doing the best he could. You know, he wanted to protect us. He didn't want anything bad to happen to us. And he said, when I left, they just cracked down on Stevie a little more because they were worried about him. And then he said, but of course, that just made Stevie try even harder.
Well,
so,
yeah.
You know, and it's all true. You know, there's nothing that isn't true about the fact that, you know, Stevie got to an extraordinary place because of his dedication and his drive and his natural innate talent, that he was God-given talent.
And mm-hmm. in terms of that, so, you know, it was sort of like I had to grapple with that when I wrote my last book, One Way Out, about the Allman Brothers, which is, you know, pretty much at every stage, there's rough stories about Greg Allman and Dickie Betts and other members involving alcohol abuse and bad marriages and violence sometimes. And I didn't want to write a book that delved into that, but if you don't write about it enough, you can't understand the dynamics of the band and how it affected the music. And, so, to some extent, for me, it was a little bit easier to understand that concept because I had done it once. But you have to have enough in there for people to really understand the situation without wallowing in it, because it's all relative to how it inspired and developed the person and his music. But it's not there for titillation's sake.
Mm-hmm. No, I didn't take it that way at all, and I didn't actually see it as dirty laundry at all. I actually saw it as, wow, now I really understand Stevie's motivation and the fire that got lit under him.
Yeah. Well, that makes us happy that that's what you took from it.
Yeah, that was definitely my takeaway. It was, you know, because, you know, I mean, I think if you talk to a lot of musicians and actors and even and especially stand-up comedians, you'll find that a lot of them came from homes that were the impetus for them becoming who they became, you know?
Right, and also that stuff is important because it sheds a little bit of light on how he started drinking and eventually using drugs. And again, that, you know, as I just said, you can't understand the story of Stevie without understanding just how bad his alcohol and drug dependency became and how thoroughly he beat it. So both of those are a huge part of the story, and they go back to his childhood as well.
And also, when Stevie got sober, in his interviews with me, he wanted to make clear that he knew that he needed to find out the root of the root cause of his addiction, and he was able to start to, you know, analyze himself and his fears and frailties and all the things that happen when you go into therapy to try to fix the things, the damage that's in your life. And I have to give Stevie all the credit for being so determined to talk about these things and share these things, you know, with me, which he knew, of course, he would be sharing with the world, because these were going into magazine articles that were going to be printed, you know, around the world.
Yeah, for sure. One of my favorite parts of the book is the weeks and the time just after Montreux, their first time, and then and the whole Bowie trip that happened for Stevie. There was so much information in there that I had never known, and it was really, really amazing, especially the stuff with Carlos Alomar.
How great is Carlos? Yeah.
Andy did that interview with Carlos Alomar, and as soon as he sent me the full interview, I was just blown away. I thought it was fantastic. I've already gotten some feedback from Stevie fans who, you know, Carlos is becoming a little bit of an enemy to people because they thought he was rude to Stevie. And I just want to put that on the record. I think that's a little out of line. You know, as a journalist and a documentarian of this stuff, I'll never want to criticize someone for being honest. And I think that Carlos was giving us a pretty honest assessment of Stevie's behavior, his strengths and weaknesses as related to being in the Bowie band, from the perspective of the Bowie band and the guy who was the musical director. And Stevie wasn't the easiest guy to deal with at that time. He was incredibly talented, and they understood that, and they were trying to work with him. And I'm not talking about the business side. There was financial stuff that went on, but just as a musician. And Carlos was, you know, his job was to run a ship, tight ship, and he was sort of honest with Stevie about some things. And so I actually appreciated him opening up, and I do think it's really insightful to be able to help us see that situation from a 360-degree mm-hmm. that we wouldn't have been able to do without him. Mm-hmm. So for the record, I'll put that out there. I don't think Carlos is an enemy, and I think he actually had great love and passion for Stevie. He was just being honest.
I think he's amazing. I love Carlos. I think he's fantastic. You know, it's so funny. I you tell me if you agree with this. My feeling with Stevie, although I never met him, I've met Jimmy multiple times. We've had multiple conversations, but I always got the feeling, just from Stevie's music and the few interviews that I had seen in video and read and stuff like that, that I think a lot of his appeal was that his intention, his kindness, his sweetness, and his ferocity all came out in the music, and I think that's why so many people really love him to this day. Would you agree with that?
I agree with that completely. I think that part of what drew people into Stevie was that, you know, if you're a guitar player or a musician, you could hear some of the virtuosity, but even if you weren't, his complete commitment to what he was doing came through. And in his singing as well. which is often overlooked because his guitar players.
Right, yeah. I loved his voice, yeah.
Everything about him was all in. He never took not only like a night off, but not only a song off, and really never a note off. Everything he played, and obviously he did play a lot of notes, but they all had an intention, and they all had a life of their own. So you could see the notes
right.
coming out from that incredible
yeah.
guitar tummy.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can feel it in the very pit of your stomach.
Yeah.
There were never any missteps with Stevie. He was like a laser beam. His artistry, his ability to play, and his ability to play music that was filled with emotion was truly extraordinary on the highest level. You know, you can talk about anybody who was able to combine tremendous, extraordinary technique with inspired musical ideas and trailblazing approach to an instrument, transcending really. And, you know, whether it's Charlie Parker or John Coltrane, and, you know, Stevie was in the realm of the greatest of the great in the same way.
Absolutely.
Just to make a tiny correction on Andy, when he said there was one brief period where he did make missteps, and because he really never did until that point, that was a signal to his bandmates and some of the other people closest to him how bad his problem was.
Yeah.
Because, during that very brief period where he was having trouble, where his playing suffered a bit, that was such a clear sign that he was in distress.
Yeah, something must have really been wrong.
Right, because it's really true that until that point, no matter what else was going on, he really didn't make missteps.
Yeah.
And, of course, after he almost died and dedicated himself to rehab and changing him, it went back to being that way and probably even more so, where his mm-hmm. playing was so pure and unerring.
Yeah. There's a quote from the book that I particularly love. It's from Brad Whitford. Folks, it's on page 230 if you want to zip to it. Brad Whitford from Aerosmith said, "There was a hole, a vacancy that most of us weren't aware of until Stevie filled it, completing the circle of greatness of Clapton, Hendrix, and Bloomfield. It just made sense. It seemed like there was a big empty spot that was his spirit filled. He came along at a time when we really needed him, and nobody knew it."
That's right. And nobody realized it until he came and he filled it. That's a great quote from Brad. So thank you, Brad Whitford.
Yeah, I love
really
that.
He zeroes in on something really specific that, when you're doing interviews with people, sometimes, even like we didn't realize that's the quote we were looking for instance. Sometimes the information that you're trying to get, and sometimes you're just talking to people and they come up with this thing that even we hadn't exactly thought of.
And this is Brad Whitford, from Aerosmith, the guy who, became one of the biggest rock stars there is, and playing, blues rock style music, and Aerosmith, he has a band, of course, because they've been around a long time, suffered, ups and downs like all bands do, and things go in and out of vogue. And, there's another part of the story, too, is that in 1983, Stevie Ray Vaughan's style of music could not possibly have been more out of vogue.
Right.
Against Flock of Seagulls and Duran Duran.
And nobody was looking for the next great blues rock guitar player.
In fact, that was the reason why a lot of record companies turned him down. They would say, "No one's looking for the next great."
Yeah, they'd say he's great. Guitar player. We hear what's great about him, but so what?
It's just like, who wants to hear this stuff?
Yeah,
it took John Hammond, the guy who discovered Billie Holiday and Bob Dylan and Charlie Christian and Bruce Springsteen, to say, "Oh no, Stevie Ray Vaughan is his brilliance is undeniable." And he said to Chris, and it's in the book, he goes, "For whatever reason, sometimes the guys that are the most obvious just seem to take a little longer."
Yeah. Well, you could even say that about Jackson Browne too. He saw something, and to offer up the studio in the manner in which he did, and of course Bowie. Everybody saw it. The insiders saw it. and which is really interesting because, you know, he was who he was in Texas, but it was kind of like he was in a bubble there until they got out of there.
That's right, but maybe the way I started to look at it is that he had to do everything he did and struggle the way he did, and the people who lived down here were lucky enough to get to see him develop before the rest of us. But by the time he got over to Montreux in 1982, which was the performance that turned David Bowie and Jackson Browne onto him, you know, became like the defining 2 days of his life in a way, because David Bowie hired him for Let's Dance, Jackson Browne offered him free studio time for what became Texas Flood. And what they were seeing was a complete package. I mean, a guy who now for a couple of years at least had been really at the height, the band was at its height, you know, the trio was completely locked in. Chris and Tommy were, you know, anticipating every move Stevie was going to make. They were supporting him brilliantly. It was like a flawless performance. And so they didn't have to see it and go, bass tightens up a little or the songwriting comes around, there's really going to be something here. No, none of that was an issue. He was completely fully formed. Mm-hmm. He was overripe, you know. I mean, he should have been discovered a year or two earlier, but the fact that he wasn't, I think, just probably is what overwhelmed David Bowie and Jackson Browne and led to everything else. It was so overwhelmingly great to be unsigned and relatively undiscovered that it must have hit those guys like a ton of bricks.
Yeah. You know, it's a little bit like, you know, I'm 63, so I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan in March and February of 1964 when I was 7 years old. And, you know, they, as everyone knows, you know, the world was knocked off its axis that one night by the appearance of the Beatles. But what I didn't learn until years later is that the Beatles have been playing together like 8 hours a day, 6 days a week for 6 years by that point. Like, they had spent all of this time honing their craft and becoming this incredible powerhouse of a band that was unlike anything anyone had ever heard. And so everyone's introduction to them, they were already the most formidable presence that they wouldn't have sounded that way, you know, if they'd only been together for 6 months or a year or 2 years. They've been given it their all for years at that point, and that's how we all discovered them. And it was very much like that with Stevie. Stevie was just exploding, and people were discovering this new guy who was, you know, hitting, you know, 10 run homers with the swing.
Yeah, I think that's actually a great point, and something that, in a way, indirectly and in a way directly, we wanted to put across in the book, which is to show how much work went into that.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like, you know, people watch Michael Jordan and think, oh, he's a natural born athlete. No, you know, he put in countless hours working on his game.
Yeah, that's part of the genius.
It is.
Is that these guys work harder than anyone. Jimi Hendrix, that's part of the genius.
You can't separate it. And that's something we really wanted to shine a light on with Stevie. And that goes back to what I said. He had put in those hours. And by the time those guys saw him, it was so great. And that's putting in the hours. Even after, listen, we talked to people going back to his high school bands. Stevie was an incredible guitar player when he was 14, mm-hmm. 15, 16. By the time he moved to Austin when he was about 18 or 19, a great guitar player. I mean, we're not talking about, like, working to get good. I'm talking about after you're already great, working to hone your craft, to have, you know, his singing put in the same amount of work eventually. And to what's your set list going to be? What's the band going to be? Who's the right bass player? What should the bass player do in this power trio? I mean, it's so much time, effort, and commitment that went into how great he was. And that's part of what we're trying to shine a light on, specifically for Stevie, but then I think it applies to, you know, greatness in general.
Well, absolutely. You know, it's interesting because the book is obviously, it's Stevie Ray Vaughan focused, but it really does pay tribute to all of the other people that were involved in that ascension. of his career. You know, I mean, I think it pays tribute to Chris and Tommy and Reese just as much, and that's really great. I love that.
Well, still Stevie blossomed because of this incredible musical community that he was immersed in. And you know, tonight at Seaboys, a lot of those people are going to be there.
Yeah,
Danny Freeman and Roddy Colonna and Tommy Shannon and Josh Daly, Alan Haynes, Jackie Newhouse, W.C. Clark. They're all going to be there tonight. And my feeling about it is, you know, there's one guy who's supposed to be in that room with us, and he's not going to be there, and that's Stevie.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, he was an essential part of this community, and that's the point, is that he was all about the community. So it's a big part of the story, but that being said, you know, Steve Ray Vaughan, the community helped Steve Ray Vaughan become this incredible, extraordinary, one-of-a-kind musician, guitar player, person who, you know, it's almost 30 years since his passing. We felt like the time to tell this story and write this book was now, and the response has just been wonderful. So I want to thank you, Mark, for, you know, taking the time to talk to us about it. And, you know, I hope everybody gets out there. We'll be at Book People today at 2 o'clock in Austin. And it's also must be noted that August 17th, 2019, is the exact 50th anniversary of the day Tommy Shannon performed at Woodstock with John Winter.
Wow.
To the day.
Yeah. And so on top of everything else, I mean, we're really honored that we're spending that 50th anniversary trip, that occasion with Tommy. He's going to be at Book People, you know, just to be there and listen to us talk. And he's going to be at Seaboys tonight, and he should be playing a couple of songs.
That's excellent.
You know, just to go back to what Andy said, it's like, it really is an honor. Like, it's tremendously a huge honor for us to be able to bring these guys together tonight and to be able to help bring Steve Ray Vaughan back into a little bit more public spotlight. So, you know, I mean, the success of the book so far is feels great. You know, anything you do that people like is satisfying. But I mean, it really sincerely for both of us, as much as anything, it feels great because we are so passionate about this music and about Steve Ray Vaughan, and the fact that we're able to help more people pay attention to him right now in 2019. Is incredibly satisfying. It's really the greatest part of the whole thing to both of us.
Well, that's excellent. One more thing I want to mention about the book, folks, you should know, is the pictures. There are pictures in this book that have never been seen before because they're coming directly from Jimmy Vaughan, and it's just amazing the being able to be inside that and see that, the inside of all of it. It's really amazing.
Well, we spent a lot of time really, like, a ridiculously insane amount of time and energy and attention to detail into picking these photos, tracking down photographers, tracking down Gary Oliver, the artist who made the Continental Calendars, who lives in like an adobe in Arizona or something, and has get his permission. So the art, the photos, the cousins gave us tons of pictures. We have over 170 pictures, most of which have never even been seen before.
Which is hard in this day to have that, but we really tried.
The cover shot, which is so beautiful, we had some candidates for the cover, and we weren't really thrilled. And I went on a search, found this picture, and then was confronted with, well, who took the picture? You know, we need the credit. And we were able to figure that out. A guy named Art Maripold, who lives in Alabama, only shot Stevie twice. And, I mean, it's just the most perfect picture for the cover of the book. And Art, of course, was so, he's thrilled that we're using that picture for the cover, and we're thrilled that he took that picture. It's just perfect and beautiful. So
the fact that we found such a beautiful picture that hadn't really been seen was Well, really, that's a credit to Andy. That's the one photo in the whole book that wasn't our job. We're responsible for finding, securing, paying for every single photo except the cover. But rather than let the art director deal with it, you know, we went looking and Andy found that one. So I'm glad he did, and then worked out because I agreed with everything else he said about it.
Well, guys, I got to tell you, it is... I think this is finally the definitive book on Stevie Ray Vaughan. I can't imagine anybody would have enough gumption to try and do another after this.
Oh, well, what you made me think of is Tommy Shannon said to me, he goes, you know, all these years, people have asked me about Stevie, what was he really like? You know, what was his story? And he goes, I got to thank you because now all I have to do is say, read the book.
Yeah, that's great. Guys, I can't thank you enough for taking some time out, and I'm looking forward to seeing you guys this evening.
We're going to see you in a little while, right?
Yeah, we'll see you guys in a little bit.
Thank you. It was a great interview. It helped us. I think it'll make our Q&A at Book People at 2 o'clock better because we just practiced. And, you know, this is all we do is spend our time thinking and talking about this, and every time we think of something new, you know, we surprise each other, we surprise ourselves because... the depth of thinking and talking about Stevie Ray Vaughan and this music we love is endless, really. There's no bottom to what we can continue to think about and talk about.
Absolutely. Well, fantastic. I look forward to seeing you guys later. Maybe we can get a drink and take a couple of pictures together. That'd be lovely. And I look forward to hearing everybody play. And folks, the book is called Texas Flood, The Inside Story of Stevie Ray Vaughan by Alan Paul and Andy Elidort. And you can get it anywhere you can buy books. Anywhere. Guys, thanks. Thanks so much. I'll see you guys later on.
You're welcome.
All right, bye-bye.
GRS Productions.